over
like what ISIL terror making any
radical. So there are only two of them that I think are tricky. Adiabatic means that there's no change in entropy, and it also means that Q is equal to zero. So isochoric, which is not a word that I ever see people actually use, is constant volume. People would always say constant volume instead. So barometric pressure should remind you that barometric has to do with pressure. So isobarometric path is going to be a constant pressure path. And therm should remind you of temperature, so an isotherm is a constant temperature. Yeah, isochoric is volume. And as I say, I don't think that's a word I would put on an exam because it's never a word that I've ever used. You see it in books. The other ones are really commonly used, isobaric, isotherm, adiabat. Entropy. Okay, so maybe start with the most recent quiz. So if you're going to do work, you have to expand, right? You have to be pushing on something. There has to be some force times the displacement. So the places where we have expansion are in A and B. So in terms of heating, it can't be on the adiabats because by definition, there are cases where Q is equal to zero. The heating is occurring at the high temperature regime. It's happening on A.
How do you know any of
that? So an adiabat has Q equals zero by definition.
Where is Q on the graph?
So Q isn't on the graph. This is a graph of pressure versus volume. But the description says that B and D are adiabats. And the word adiabat means Q is zero. You're not happy with that. Are you getting happy with that? No, so anything that's expanding, A and B are expanding, right? We're going to larger volumes. So those are cases where work is done.
So we found that out just because it said like adiabatic expansion, because the other two, so C and D said compressed, and that's why we know how work, because of the expansion part.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't have focused on the words. The graph shows that we went from this volume to that volume. And we went from this volume to that volume. And the table, of course, shows the same things. The volumes are getting larger as we go from 1 to 2 to 3.
So that's really all that work. That's how you can identify work, is if it's expanding.
If it's expanding, work is being done. That is to say, W is negative. Right? Yeah, so you got to be careful. So W is positive if it's compressing. We got this problem of work done and work on. And the symbol W means work on. And that's not a common statement. So usually people would use work as being the work done by, but our book uses it the work done on.
So on the test, W means work done on the gas?
Yes. Yep. So W, if it's not explained, you can always ask, but the book's definition is the definition that will be on exams, and it's the work done on. If I say the work done by, then that's what I mean, right? But if I just give you the symbol W, I want the work done on.
Okay, and then for the second one that's saying it was heated or Q, we knew that it wasn't B and D because it says adiabatic.
Yes.
But then what is wrong with C? How do we know that C isn't, like, what's the distinction between A and C?
So what's happening here is heat is flowing into the gas from the high temperature regime. So Q is positive, and heat is flowing out of the gas at the low temperature regime.
Okay.
So Q is negative. You could also get those numbers from using that table, but it's not really what I would recommend. So just looking at the plot, you can tell what's going on. Now, maybe I have to be a little bit careful, or at least make things clear. This was a heat engine, right? It was running that Carnot cycle that way. If we're running a refrigerator, right, that's where we run everything backwards. So this is the same shape, but now when we go from here to here, we're reducing the volume. So that means that W is positive, and minus W is what we wanted. So where the gas is doing work under these circumstances for the refrigerator are going to be in D and C. I mean, it's a matter of which way the arrows are going. If delta, if the volume is increasing, then the work is negative, W is negative. And of course, as usual, delta means final minus initial, right? More miscellaneous questions. Okay, so the volume is increasing for A and B, so that's why the work, that's why it, W is less than zero and the gas is doing work. Only in A is the gas being heated, which should sound funny because the temperature isn't changing, right? But in fact, heat is still flowing into that gas even though its temperature isn't changing. So for the rest of the questions, what's involved are the two laws of thermodynamics that we know. At least that's how I would work them. The change in internal energy is equal to Q plus W, and if the temperature is constant, then the change in entropy is the heat divided by the temperature. So for the adiabats, which is to say for B and D, Q is zero. So the work that's done is the change in internal energy. And if you look at those numbers, it's exactly the same change of internal energy, right? It's just one time we're going up and the other time we're going down. So the absolute value of the work is exactly the same.
Okay, and then for the plus or is greater than or less than, B is greater than D, I'm assuming then?
No, they're exactly the same. Well, it's not on the graph. It's from what we've just said. So they're adiabats, so Q is equal to zero.
Oh, right. Okay.
We're good?
Yeah. Okay.
More questions?
So why isn't past D, why isn't helium heated there?
A little bit louder?
In past D, how come helium isn't heated? So
in D?
Yeah.
So this is an adiabat. So by definition, Q is zero. So this is one of these odd statements. So for A, it was being heated, but the temperature didn't change. So here, the temperature changed, it went up, but it wasn't heated. There's a big difference between heat and temperature.
What was the answer?
For the third one?
Second.
So for the second one, the only place heat is going in is from the high temperature regime. It's from A. B and D, Q is equal to zero, and for C, heat is being sucked from the material, Q is negative.
How much did each of these questions work
on? So the distribution was 4, 4, 2, 6, 4. She asked what the point value was of the questions. We're good on 1 through 3? Yep.
One more time. You said heat comes out on path C.
Yes.
How do we know that from that graph?
So there are lots of ways you can get it. I think the easiest way is to remember that this is a heat engine. So automatically, it's taking heat in from the high temperature regime and dumping it at the cold temperature regime. If you look at the equations that we had for Q under lots of different circumstances, well, yeah, there are lots of ways of doing it. So another way of doing it is to look here. We know that there's no change in internal energy for that pass C. And we know that W is positive because it's compressing, so Q has to be negative. We could look at the change in entropy. You know, all of these things are going to tell us that Q is negative. But I think the easiest way is just to remember that that's how heat engines work. They take heat from the high temperature regime and they dump them to the low temperature regime. And refrigerators would work exactly the opposite. They'd suck heat out of the refrigerator and dump it into the kitchen.
So taking heat from like a hot reservoir is negative Q?
Anytime you take heat from something, Q is less than zero. So this is another really kind of weird thing that maybe I shouldn't mention, but I will. So I hope have learned about exothermic reactions in chemistry. And those are reactions that the reaction gets hot. But what's happening is heat is leaving that reaction. So Q is negative. I mean, it sounds backwards, right? But if you think about it, it should make sense. Does it? Maybe? Sort of. On to four. So for four, we're dealing with this isotherm. And if you just look at the numbers, there's no change in internal energy. So automatically, we know that Q is the opposite of W. So we'll be good if we can calculate either one of those two. Notice that this is an isotherm, so the temperature is a constant. So we can calculate the Q because we know what the delta S is, right? The beginning S and final S are given, so all we need to do is to multiply them by the temperature to get the Q. And once we've got the Q, we've got the W because there's no change in internal energy. Q plus W is zero. Now, I'll remark that almost everyone who worked this problem worked it with the stuff that was on the table. And it works fine that way, too, if it's an ideal gas. Right? So helium is pretty close to an ideal gas, so you could use those equations if you wanted to. But this way, to me, is easier and is general. So that's,
Like only when we have an ideal gas, like when it's stated in the problem, this is an ideal gas, would you want us to use those? Or in all instances, would you want us to use the simpler equations?
So probably 80% of the entries in that table have used the ideal gas law. Not 100%, but maybe 80%. So under some circumstances, some of those numbers are general. So for example, there's an entry in that table that says that for an adiabatic process, Q is equal to zero. That's always true.
And I understand that, but when we're looking at a question that you give us, you know, such as the one that you gave us on this quiz, is there a certain situation where you would want us to use that table as opposed to just a simple?
So I think of course, whatever works is good.
Yeah.
I think if I've given you numbers for internal energies and entropies, I'm probably thinking you're going to work it this way. If it's an ideal, like in this homework problem, it's an ideal gas. I mean, so helium is very close to an ideal gas. So you're perfectly fine to use that table.
But you could use those.
Yeah, I would always. So I would, if the numbers are given, I'd always use this. I think this is easier.
Okay.
You don't have to calculate any logarithms. You don't have to do any work. You just have to calculate differences. So these are always true. These are laws of thermodynamics. They're never not true.
Yeah.
You can always use them if you've got those entropies and internal energies.
Okay. Is there any instance, like when you would be asking a question where you would not be giving us those numbers? Like, would you give us a question where those would be applicable?
Would not. So there is no circumstance where this would not be applicable.
Okay.
These are always true, like Newton's laws. Even, in fact, in some sense, they're more true than Newton's laws. But in a conceivable problem, I wouldn't have given you those numbers, and then you couldn't use them, right? So if I don't tell you what S was before and after, you can't do that. And we've worked lots of problems like that also. But I guess you should be wary. Well, you can always ask, can I assume this is an ideal gas? More questions?
Is there a way you could have done it with equations from the top?
Yeah, that's how most people did it.
Right, but I didn't get the same answer with doing it that way.
So aside from rounding problems, you will get the same answer from doing it that way. Okay. So let's talk briefly about how to do these same things with that table, since helium is pretty much an ideal gas. So for the Q for this isotherm, if you look at that table, I think it said that Q was minus W. I can't remember what's on that table. And in any case, W is minus nRT, natural logarithm of final volume over initial volume. And you just plug and chug, right? The temperature is 600, R is 8.31. I told you it was one mole. And not only did I give you those volumes, but I also told you that the logarithm of it was one. So you'll get the same answer if you do that.
Yeah, I see. I didn't account for the negative Q equals W. I didn't even have it. I figured it out.
So, and of course, we've got that this is minus Q. For this, for the last part, for this adiabatic expansion, it says that the work is the number of moles, the specific heat at constant volume, times the change in temperature. And it's a monoatomic gas, so the specific heat is 3/2 R. And of course, we know the change in temperature is minus 300 degrees.
How did you get 3/2 R? Is that the degrees of
freedom? Yes. Yep. So the specific heat at constant volume is F over 2 times R, and the specific heat at constant pressure is F plus 2 over 2 times R. So that the ratio of specific heats, which is the factor gamma, is F plus 2 over F. So with the kind of practice quiz problems that we did in class today, lots of people were forgetting this equation. So don't forget that equation.
Can you refresh us about that?
So that's the adiabatic expansion equation. So if you wanted to, if here is an adiabat, if you wanted to know what the pressure and volume, if you know what the pressure and volume is at this point and you wanted to figure out what it was at that point, then you'd typically be doing something like this.
And then at the top you had W equals N. Okay, so that you're saying is a constant volume.
Yes.
How in that case is that a constant volume? Because isn't it decreasing or increasing in volume in that case?
Yeah, it is. But I think that's what's on the formula anyway.
So do we ignore the
Wait. No, okay, yeah, everything I said is true.
So do we just ignore the constant volume part and just pretend that it's constant? Or, like, how do we know that that could have worked even though it's technically not constant?
So you're saying... So I see what the problem is. Yeah, I see that the problem is. So the first thing I want to tell you is, as far as I know, those entries in the table are correct. And that's the entry in the table. So why is that? How could it be that equation that talks about constant volume applies to a non-constant volume case? And the way this thing came about is, that we know that since Q is equal to zero, W is equal to the change in energy. And the energy depends on the specific heat at constant volume. So that's the how and why. Remember that the specific heat, that the internal energy doesn't depend on the pressure, it just depends on the temperature. More questions? So I think I've said to both classes that if you're going to guess what the problems are, it's an awful good guess that three of those problems are going to be ones similar to the quiz problems, right? So pretty much a sure thing that there's going to be something like this, something like Bernoulli's equation, and something like the Q equals MC delta T thing that we had for quiz 8. Yes, that's next on the list. Somebody had a question about quiz 7. Are we done with quiz 9? I'm going to have to borrow your quiz 7.
Oh, sure.
The number? I've forgotten. So it's easy to figure. The answer is just the difference in internal energies.
What's the answer to number 2 on quiz 9?
For number 2, A. Or for number 2, A, yeah. Just A. Good to go on quiz 7. So I remind you that all of these things are online as screencasts. So you can, if you got more questions, they're there. So quiz 7 is a Bernoulli equation problem, and Bernoulli equation is that the pressure plus 1/2 the density times the speed plus rho g y, this is a constant. And typically these sort of is a constant sort of problems, you do them like, you know, P1 V1 over T1 is P2 V2 over T2. That is to say, we're going to equate the pressure and velocity and height at two different locations. So what are the two locations? So the picture has this hose, and we might as well call this position 2 and the position right after the pump number 1. But the first question is, how much water must the pump suck from the lake? And always associated with the Bernoulli equation is the equation of continuity, which says that the area times the velocity is a constant. And that constant is the flow rate. And what I mean by the flow rate is the number of cubic meters per second. So we can evaluate that constant any place we want, and what we know is information about the nozzle. We're told that the velocity there was 20 meters a second, and we're told that the diameter of the nozzle is 1 centimeter. So plug and chug, we've got pi times the radius, might as well convert to meters, and then times the velocity, 20. So whatever that turns out to be, that's what the flow rate is. And you can check the units. We've got meters squared here times meters per second. So we are going to get cubic meters per second. So we've got pi and 0.005 squared and times 20. And I get 1.57 times 10 to the minus third, which is, of course, 1.57 liters per second. Okay, so next thing we're supposed to figure out is what the pressure on the pump is. Yes?
I'm sorry, I just can't quite read that. What does that say on the left-hand side of the equation with pi in it?
Here?
On the left-hand side.
A. Right, so the area times the velocity has to be a constant.
What does it say right above the point 2? It says V equals
Oh, yeah. So that's the speed. So if you don't have your hard copy, and incidentally, lots of you don't pick up that. If you're missing something that you should have picked up, I can probably give it to you after class. So the problem says that the exit speed is 20 meters a second. Okay. And the pressure is atmospheric pressure. Which is 1.01 times 10 to the fifth. Okay, so if we're going to have y values, we have to declare where y is equal to 0. We might as well do that at the pump. So we have the pressure at the pump plus 1/2 the density of water, which is 1,000, times the velocity at the pump squared plus rho g0. That has to be atmospheric pressure, the pressure at the nozzle, plus 1/2 rho times 20 squared plus rho g times the 10 meters that it is up. Okay, so we're not there yet because this is what we want, but we still have one unknown in there. We don't know what the velocity is at 2. But we've got our continuity equation, which says that v1 has to be a2 divided by a1 times v2. And of course, these areas are pi over 4 times diameter squared. So it's just the ratio of diameters squared times v2. And the exit diameter is 1 centimeter. The entrance diameter is 10 centimeters. So this is 1/10 squared times v2. So that's 1/100 of 20, which is 0.2 meters per second.
Is it 15
and not 10? Say again? Oh. Yes, it is 15 and not 10, which would mean I have to use a calculator, I guess. So I get 0.0889 meters per second. Okay, so we've got this. The density of water is 100, so the only unknown is P1. It's a plug and chug. So, and G is of course 9.8. So this is the y2, which is 10 meters, and this is the y1, which is 0.
He's asking about the density of water.
Yeah, where do you plug in density of water?
So this, I see you're saying you can't tell the p's from the, so everything except these are rows. So, if the flow is exposed to the atmosphere, then it's at atmospheric pressure.
I'm sorry, I don't have the hard copy in front of me. We're trying to find that P1.
Yes.
The question is, what's the pressure at the pump right there? So typically, you're going to use MKS units, so the density of water is 1,000. Okay, so almost for sure, Bernoulli equation, continuity equation problems. We worked lots of them for homework. More questions? So the buoyancy force question on that we did for practice today, we could do that one. But generally speaking, the buoyancy force problems they're good for multiple choice questions because they can be very confusing and tricky. But in terms of the equation, it's all pretty simple, right? The buoyant force is just the volume displays the density of the fluid times g. I don't know, so. So there is, in the 10X, there was a problem that was similar to what we did in lab. So I think there's a container of mercury, and we put it on a scale and it reads zero. And we float a cube of aluminum, and the scale reads 22. I could have the numbers wrong. I don't know if somebody wants to correct me. And then we push the aluminum under the water, and the scale reads like 120 or something like that. 108. And we're supposed to figure out the densities of pretty much everything. And I think the cube is 1 centimeter on a side. 2 centimeters on a side? Thanks. So density is mass over volume, and even though we're weighing this aluminum in kind of a funny way, I hope it's clear that the aluminum weighs 22 grams. So the density of the aluminum should be the 22 grams divided by the volume of a cube of side 2, and so that's 2 centimeters cubed. So from this data, we were supposed to figure out what the buoyant force was, what the density of mercury is. And if we kind of think about this in terms of a free body diagram, here is the mercury with a hole in it where the object is. What are the forces on this system? Well, it has some weight. And it has some canceling force from the tear, which is exactly equal to the weight. And the other force that's present is the reaction force to the buoyant force. The mercury is pushing the aluminum up. The aluminum is pushing the mercury down. So the buoyant force has to be equal to this 108 grams. Well, when multiplied by g, has to be equal to that. So the buoyant force should be the density of the fluid times the volume, which displaced, which is the volume of a cube of 2 centimeters on a side, times g. And that has to equal this 108 times g. Well, I should say 0.18. Well, we can use centimeters or we can use meters. Let's use grams and centimeters. So if we do that, then we've got that the density of the fluid is the 108 grams divided by the 2 centimeters cubed. More questions?
Is the force of buoyancy arrow pointing the same way as the mass times gravity?
Yeah, it is.
I thought buoyancy pushed up on the solid.
It did. Right? So here's the aluminum, and it has an equal and opposite force, which is the one we usually think about that's lifting it.
Right. Oh,
but Newton. Newton promises us if the mercury is pushing the aluminum up, the aluminum is pushing the mercury down.
So that box in there you just drew, that's the buoyant force, but then is that an FR right next to it? That's the force like reaction.
So this thing here?
No, the...
So these are both FBs. So the upward force is the force of the mercury on the aluminum. The downward force should have the same size arrow, is the force of the aluminum pushing the mercury down.
And that's like the reaction force, right?
Yes. Yep.
Could you go over some more chapter 12 problems?
So that was the most recent chapter that we had. So there's a lot in that chapter. So what we've got in there is Carnot cycle stuff, and we've got the thermodynamic stuff and PV diagrams. There's stuff at the beginning of that chapter too, which I can't quite remember.
The end is harder than the beginning.
So what sort of problem do you want to work? So is this like the house problem? I can't remember.
No, it says a heat pump has a coefficient of performance at 3.9 and operates with a power consumption of 6.8 times the third. How much energy does it deliver into a home during 24 hours?
So the setup for this is a heat pump. And a heat pump is basically using your refrigerator to heat your house. So what we have is a system which is taking heat from the cold outside and pumping it into your house, which is warmer. So in terms of kind of the diagrams we have, the house is the hot diagram, the outside is the cold diagram, and we have work that is joining with this upward heat. And the coefficient of performance under this circumstance is, you know, what we care about, which is heating our house, divided by the work. So, and we're told that this is 3.9, something like that. Mm-hmm. So how much work is being done in 24 hours? Well, we're told what the power is, 3.6 times 10 to the 8 watts. So that is joules per second. So to get the total work that's being done, we need to take that power and multiply it by the time, right? 24 hours in a day, and each day has...
Okay, that's what I heard.
And when we plug that in there, we're all set to get the amount of heat that was dumped into the house.
And then on the same problem, it said, how much energy does it extract from the outside air? Now, is that QC that you find, or what?
Yep, and you can do that pretty easily because conservation of energy says that the absolute value of QC plus W has to equal QH. So we've got this total amount of heat here. We've just calculated QH, so all we have to do is subtract them to get QC. So another problem I got asked a lot of questions about was, I can't remember exactly what it was, a heat engine that was melting ice, something like that. So you calculated earlier how much heat you were dumping, and basically it's just setting that equal to the mass times the rate of heat, mass times the latent heat of fusion of the ice. And one of the things that's funny about that is the heat is being dumped at 18 degrees Celsius or something like that, but obviously it's having its effect at 0 degrees Celsius. So you might wonder what's happening between 18 and 0. And I think we're not supposed to ask that question. Maybe that just confused people as opposed to helping them. Did they?
Yeah, they gave us the specific heat too. So that's what, because it says what maximum amount of water at 18 degrees Celsius could the freezer freeze in a single day. But they gave us both the specific heat.
No, so this is a different problem.
Oh.
So what problem is it that you're asking
this
about?
Is
yeah, so there, for that problem, we do need to include the specific heat.
Okay. Can't you just set up MC delta T plus that ML?
Yeah, so we're going to have MC delta T plus ML is equal to whatever heat we're taking out, and nicely the M factors out. And we can be a little bit confused about signs, but I think you're going to do fine if you don't worry too hard about it.
Can you repeat when to use positive ML and when to use negative?
So if we're freezing something, then we're taking heat out of it. If we're melting something, then we're adding heat to it. Adding heat is positive Q. Removing heat is negative Q. So kind of the standard problem that we had for our calorimetry quiz, we were melting ice. And so we had a big string of Q equals MC delta T stuff. And starting with the ice, we had the mass of the ice times the specific heat of the ice, its initial temperature, which was some negative number, and then it went to 0 degrees. And this was heat that was added to it, so we wanted it to be a positive number. Then we needed to melt that ice as a positive number. And then we needed to take what was ice and is now water and raise it from 0 degrees to the final temperature.
So melting gives us negative and freezing gives us positive. Or use positive.
So melting takes positive heat and freezing takes negative heat. So if we were to start with something very cold and freeze part of the water, yeah, let's work a problem like that. So, I don't know, somehow or other, I'm not sure I want to make up a whole problem, somehow or other we have a situation that's going to end up with what was water becoming ice. So we're going to there have the mass of water, the specific heat of water, its initial temperature that might be 20 degrees, and we need to bring it to zero. And then we need to freeze it, and so we're going to have negative that mass of water times the latent heat of fusion. And then we have what was water but is now ice that started at zero, and it's going to end up at some negative final temperature. And all these terms are negative. This one may not look negative, but this is, say, minus 10 or something like that. So I will give you every constant except G. Say again? So I think R is given to you also. I can't remember. I think I've probably told you at some point you should know R. You really should know the density of water, for example. But I think I would probably give you that also.
So 1,000 kilograms
per cubic meter. If there's a constant that you don't know, just ask. I think I usually also give you G, even though you really should know that one. So let me take a little bit away from that. Typically when I give you constants, I say something like R equals 8.31. And you have to know what that R is. So it may be smart, on, you know, if you have room on your cheat sheet, you might want to say, the gas constant is blank, blank, blank. But I will use the standard symbols. I won't try and, you know, say Q is 8.31 or something like that.
Did you say that this table from the sheet we can take and put right on our...
I would recommend it, yep.
I mean, can we, like, just scan and put it on there, or do we have to handwrite it?
No, you can do whatever. So it's actually as a PDF, so if you wanted to, you could Xerox out, you could print out that PDF and just add your own equations to it. Anyway, any way you want to get those equations on it is fine with me.
Okay.
Yeah, so you don't... I don't care whether, it's smart for you to make out your own cheat sheets, right? But if you found a cheat sheet online that you liked and printed it out, I wouldn't object.
So would you buy my online?
I actually have done that in the past, but I don't do it because I think you learn. So one of the things that happens is exactly what I just suggested. The equation you want is there, but you don't know what the variables are, so it doesn't help. So unless you know what those symbols mean, a cheat sheet is of absolutely no value.
Okay, when do we need to know whether to keep it in Celsius or change it to Kelvin? If it's a change in temperature and they give us it in Celsius, we just can keep it in Celsius, right?
So first of all, if you're in doubt, you can always change them to Kelvin. It won't hurt. It never hurts to go to Kelvin. Changes in temperature, it doesn't matter what you use. So like these Q equals MC delta T's, they're all delta T's, and typically we're thinking in terms of Celsius, so I would always just leave them in Celsius. Anytime you see a T that's standing alone, like PV equals NRT or S equals Q over T, those things have to be in absolute units. So first of all, that's exactly the sort of stuff that might be part of a multiple choice question, but we haven't worked any, I guess we worked some problem that asked you to calculate a Reynolds number, but it's not amenable to a problem type problem. So the name of the game there is simply that at large Reynolds number, which typically means large velocities, large sizes, small viscosities, you're going to get turbulent flow as opposed to laminar flow. And what turbulent flow means is that the flow velocity at some point isn't a constant. It's changing as little eddies go by, whereas with laminar flow, the velocity at a point is always the same. The one equation we've had that involves laminar flow, that Percival's equation, I think what I told you is that I've seen that on MCAT. So it's an equation that you want to have some familiarity with, but it also kind of isn't amenable to problem type problems, right? Because it's a plug and chug. There isn't a way of making it into more than that.
Okay. So you said the three quizzes are going to be important. Now, any other clues on the other two problems?
Well, so I mean, you can make out your own list, right? There are three chapters,
yep.
So every chapter is going to get. Those three quizzes cover those three chapters. So what's the second most important thing in those chapters? And you can probably come up with a pretty good guess as to what the other questions are. So the other things that have been in the sample problems, the sample exams, were things like buoyant force problems, and there was a thermal conductivity problem. Anybody else remember different sort of problems?
Is there going to be most likely a module, like shear module, or with the constant, like shear and then Young and all of those?
Well, so I don't know what I want to say about that. Those problems are best amenable, again, to kind of multiple choice type things. They're kind of plug and chugs as opposed to being something that you can make more out of. But we did work some problems that are like that. And the one problem I liked the most was the tooth problem. Do you remember that one, where you had the combination of thermal expansion and Young's modulus to make it interesting.
Are there any other problems you specifically like?
So let me tell you, that problem isn't on the exam. So just because I like a problem doesn't mean it's going to be there. I'm not sure I would have paid specific attention to that just because I liked it. So remember that the problems that I did in class, those are online. Right? There's a big PDF that has every problem that we worked in class. Not the solutions, just the questions. So there is a PDF of the, yeah, so you should be able to print out the 105t3x.pdf. So the webcast, of course, you can't print out. But there is something that if you print it out, it'll look just like an exam that I handed to you. It's made by exactly that same process, and its name is 105t3x.pdf.
Is there a screen cap of the answers for that on there
too? Yes. And if you haven't done the screencast, you got to, right? You really want to. If you're having trouble doing it, you really want to talk to me. So the answers to lots of these things are in screencast form, MP4 format, as videos. If I can find my glasses, there they are.
This was the quiz one, but I kind of, these were three separate equations. I know this is different from this, but is this rearranging this? Or
say again?
This is the V1 equals A2 equals A1.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is this rearranging, well, this?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then this was to find V1 to be able to find P1, right?
Yes.
And all the densities were water?
Yes. Okay. So everything was water.
Okay, and then this one, this H1.
So why do you have 15?
Oh, I think I heard you say it was 15.
No, I think it's 10. I think it's 10 meters high.
Oh, yeah.
So what is 15 is this D2. I originally wrote that as 10.
Okay, and then why was it originally 0? Because it's starting from...
So we're free to define where the origin is any place we want.
So,
I could have taken y to be 0 up here, in which case this one would be minus 10.
Okay.
But I chose it to be there.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, no, that's why we
all... Can you define just what these are quickly?
So this is the work. And this is, of course, heat. So this is the change in internal energy. And this is entropy change.
So can you cycle over what internal energy change is?
Well, you know what change is, so yeah. I guess you're telling me you don't know what internal energy is.
Yeah.
So it's energy that's, so for an ideal gas, it's the kinetic energy of these molecules, right? They're moving fast, even though net-net they're not moving. They're moving this way and that. So there's kinetic energy that's associated with it. In a chemical process, that internal energy would include the bond energy that's holding the thing together.
Okay. That makes sense.
I know it's the first day. It's Monday.
Hmm?
Okay. But I'm not sure.